I'm John Carpenter, and the movie begins with Abco Embassy Pictures Presents, and we're into Escape from New York. We made this picture in 1980. It was written in 1974, 6 years before we shot it. And this was before Ronald Reagan was president. Jimmy Carter was still president. He was having trouble with Billy Carter at the time. And it's a story about a guy who goes into a prison and has to rescue the President of the United States. And it seemed to have a resonant quality because at the time, our hostages were still over in Iran and we were still worried about that situation. It was a real turning point in America when we made it. It was the beginning of a whole new decade. And people don't really realize about this was actually a low budget picture at the time. We only had about $5 million to make this movie, but we were trying to make a real giant film with it. So one of the things that gives away a low-budget film is the credits, white over black, and this is exactly what we have with music going. We had a sensational cast led by Mr. Kurt Russell, who happens to be sitting next to me at this moment.
I mean, I'm hearing a lot of things for the first time, and I hadn't thought about, I guess maybe we did talk about it at the time, but I don't remember, that it did have a resonance that that existed around the hostage time. That was just ongoing. It seemed like it was never going to end.
And that our whole pride was kind of wrapped up in that big debacle in the desert when the helicopters crashed. By the way, both of our ex-wives are in this movie.
That's right. We're gonna get to see and remember a lot of good times here. I do. You know, I remember seeing this picture for the first time fully with an audience, and I was in New York and couldn't get my family into the theater. I was trying to convince the guy that I was in the movie. And he wasn't going to take that, so I paid the way for my seven family members and myself. We saw it with a great audience. It was an almost all-black audience deep in the heart of New York City, and I got to tell you, from the first time they saw the title, they just started hooting and hollering and having a great time. There's Larry.
And he is your...
Larry was, at that time, married to my oldest sister, Jill. They're no longer married either. You know, thinking about this is going on here. Larry and you and I had first worked together on Atlas.
That's right. That was like 2 years earlier. And as we start to film, kind of telling everybody what's going on, because I realized I screened the picture for an audience and they had no idea anything about New York as a prison until too late in the movie. So we had to actually draw a map and say, here's the prison and here's what's happened. And I think in science fiction movies, especially movies where you're trying to set the rules for the future, you have to do it in a very clear way right up front so the audience says, aha, I understand where you're taking me. So basically there's the animation that shows the wall around New York. And this was before... all the effects in this movie were before any kind of computer effects. So we're doing this the old-fashioned way. This is all animated. And it's too bad because we sure could have used some digital stuff. But it hadn't been invented yet.
I remember how great the music was. And I remember going in one time to listen to you. And was it Alan Howarth?
Alan Howarth, yeah.
And it sounded great. And then when I saw it on the screen, I thought, God, this is perfect music for this movie.
So now we're established, we're in 1997, and our little crawl is over with, and we began the film. Actually, this part was shot right over here in the Sepulveda Basin. We utilized the wall over there and had helicopters going over. This is a kind of an interesting trick shot. We come up into darkness and move out of darkness after we establish where we are, and now we're cutting over to the new world, a special effects group, and Jim Cameron's bunch, and we're coming out. Now we're on a special effects stage with a front screen behind. And as I recall, a kind of funky-looking guard walking along. I think it was one of the guys working on the movie with a baggy uniform, and there we go. Nice matte paintings in the background. All phony. Another matte painting with a toy helicopter flying over, all animated. Very nicely done, though. They split in the water. And hardly any lights over in the city. Here we go. Now the foreground are two men trying to escape, and they're basically out in out in the water here off the off of Long Beach, and we're shooting this whole sequence.
This is fun to see this because, of course, you know, I don't know whether people know it or not, but as an actor in the show, when you're not in a scene, you generally run around. So when you see the movie for the first time, you get to see all the stuff that wasn't shot and see how it comes out from what you read. You shot this in Long Beach?
Yes. There goes the dummy flying. Now we're back to another special effects shot. Actually, these are extremely ambitious shots for the kind of budget and the kind of wherewithal we had at that time. And this is all paintings with an animated helicopter and extremely well done. Now we're on location in New York. And we do...
This is the one day we were... What were we, one or 2 days?
We were 2 days in New York. Here we are at the Statue of Liberty on the backside of the Statue of Liberty. And we do our tie-in shot between New York and the Sepulveda Basin. Basically, Tom Atkins is coming out. He's going to walk into a booth. And we do a long, slow tracking shot, which is going to take us from New York. And in the middle of it, in black, we cut to Los Angeles. So here we go. He's giving some... expository dialogue. So we're trying to set up that New York is a prison run by a kind of paramilitary police force. And here we go. Liberty Island Security Control. Camera's still tracking.
Was that in New York still?
This is still in New York. And now in black here, as we pass through, we do a quick dissolve, and now we come out in L.A. Here we are in Los Angeles, in the basin. And there are helicopters flying around and our gigantic set. Actually, it looks very futuristic and very good, but we wanted to utilize all these concrete structures and wet down the floors. And here comes the bus.
I remember we were excited about that. I was really excited about this bus because you'll notice that it stops and it kind of tilts to the right. Remember those buses that they were? We kind of thought that was pretty futuristic.
The courtesy bus, it tilts it as you get out. And here you are. Here you come. Let's see. How many years ago was this?
This is amazing. This is now 14. What is this? 14 years ago.
It's pretty amazing.
I remember for the first time in my life, I was going to have to really try to get in shape physically for a movie. I always admired the fact that you had great courage and belief that I could lose about 20 pounds and get in shape.
And now we're shooting this entire sequence here, done with a Panaglide. It's shot at a college in Los Angeles where we found the architecture to be rather futuristic but bleak. And this is the inside of the police station. Supposedly, Snake Plissken, the main character played by Kurt, is a nefarious criminal who's about to be put away in New York. And we're establishing that before we get into the main body of the action. If you've watched any of the interview section of the tape, you know that there was a 10-minute sequence that we cut out of the picture where you robbed a bank.
Yeah, I can remember you...
And we had to cut it out because the audience was totally confused. But now they're with it. So now we've introduced our main character. Now we get to the plot. And here comes one of my favorite actors in the picture, Lee Van Cleef, who I really enjoyed working with. An amazing person. Somebody we all grew up with from High Noon, from the Spaghetti Westerns.
I can remember that we talked a great deal about the quality of Snake and how we do him. We said if Lee Van Cleef was going to play that role, it would be kind of fun to do Snake a little bit like Eastwood. Kind of give it that Eastwood voice quality maybe and have the fun of having done that with Lee Van Cleef.
And kind of resonate the Sergio Leone pictures here in the future.
I also remember that that stuff was done early on, the stuff with Snake in the beginning, because the studio was concerned that he had no socially redeeming value. And you believed, you said, I don't know, I think he's going to be okay.
He doesn't really have much socially redeeming value, but now we're into the plot now. Basically, we're going to discover that the president's plane has been hijacked. Again, if you notice the visual style of a lot of these scenes, they're very simple and done in one take with a lot of moving camera. Basically, because of our short schedule, we had to take something and make it look big and stretch it. And part of my job as a director is to make sure we get our work done. So here you have all this expository dialogue, basically two or three shots, and in this entire scene in the voiceover. Tom Atkins and...
He's really good here, wasn't he, Tommy?
Oh, he's fantastic. Everybody invested a real reality into the movie so that you really believe that you are in this time and place.
I remember in that stuff we shot in Atlanta, talking about getting the movie shot and getting it done. Remember when the camera dolly broke down and you had to use a baby carriage? You put the camera on a baby carriage.
Now, this is a very ambitious shot in terms of a model shot. Here you have clouds going by. This is a revolutionary screaming about the workers and so forth. And we're about to meet the President of the United States, but first, if you'll notice in a second, when we cut to the interior of the cabin, there's a tall, blonde Secret Service man who's banging on the door. He is Gerald Ford's son, Steve Ford. There he is.
I thought that was cool, too, in the beginning. That was, at that time, too, putting a woman in that role was just those little things were different about this movie.
Kind of twisted. And now here's Donald, the President. Donald made up an entire story about how he got to be president. It had something to do with Margaret Thatcher taking over the world and making the United States a colony again, but I never used any of it. And basically, he's going to this specially designed presidential pod, which I now realize as a writer doesn't make any sense at all. But it's a whole lot of fun to watch. A lot of this is a James Bond kind of gimmicks, which are always fun. There's a heart monitor on the president so you can keep track of him, and he gets in his egg. Donald had a great time making this film. He finally realized it was going to be a comedy. Again, we're coming up with some ambitious special effects shots. We had to structure these shots. The crash itself had to be done basically as an animation shot, but here we go. A beautiful model tracking right in on the building. Here comes the crash, right there. But we do it animated, so we didn't have to blow up anything. Basically, this is all the plot area. Again, we're shooting all these sequences with wide camera angles, trying to give you a spectacle when we have really very limited means. This was one of my first exposures to helicopters.
I was going
to
say, was this what got you going?
This began to get me excited about it, and I became a pilot. Actually, you're a pilot too now.
Fixed wing, and you went to those moving wings.
That's right. But I really enjoyed the Hueys. They were really fantastic. Now they're actually flying. This is the National Guard that we got out to do this. They're flying over the Sepulveda Basin, basically waking up the neighborhood in the middle of the night. But now we cut to a special effects shots, and those are animated helicopters.
Now, was this guy on a stage?
He is on a sound stage with a front screen in the background. And now we're back on location. And if you'll notice how much of this was done through animation to try to explain what's going on, simply because we didn't have the money. Now we're cutting to St. Louis, Missouri, right down the middle of downtown, where we have used it as a stand-in for New York. And there was a big fire in St. Louis in 1977. It gutted the downtown area, so we came in and used it, and it's very effective. The city let us turn off all the lights for blocks and blocks. And here we are in St. Louis.
Boy, I remember that place was desolate. There weren't even bums on that street.
Desolate and hot. This is in the middle of the summer. It was 106 degrees at night. It was very, very humid. It was not a fun place to be. And Lee is going to make his entrance now. He didn't want to get out of the helicopter because he doesn't like helicopters. Now, Lee had fallen off a horse and broken his knee and had never really had it fixed. So his wife was on location, and she said one of the biggest things about this scene was him walking down the street without his knee buckling. He has a real hard time moving. He's quite a strong man and very dedicated to the movie and very dedicated to his acting profession, so he did a terrific job.
He was really fun. He did have a presence, didn't he?
He sure did. And notice that flare in the middle of the screen. These are early Panavision lenses that were developed in 1980 that could shoot at a very low light level. And without them, we would have been in big trouble because if you notice, in the background of a lot of these shots, you see way down the block. And that's the ability to do that without every light in Hollywood was what got us the look. Unfortunately, we have to be very careful of the focus, because that's the one thing in Panavision Anamorphic that you're always having trouble with, is focus. Now, Frank Doubleday arrives in his makeup.
He was definitely into it.
He was definitely into it, and
he was great here. I always felt that this characterization in this scene sort of really set the tone for the rest of the show.
You hear him talking through his phony teeth. It's too bad I didn't replace his voice, but in those days we didn't have the bucks. No, the whole set design, the whole feel of the film with a lot of smoke and blue light. It's really the no light look is what we're talking about. All the light that you see is presumably coming from either fires or moonlight. And it's a very nice look. It's something that I've seen since. It's been copied a lot.
Yeah, that had just not been done then. I remember the audience just taking to that, because it was a look that, as you said, it's been copied a lot. It really set a tone for a lot of different movies.
As the helicopters raise up, you might see some of the paint peeling off because of the wind situations inside this little square. We tried to hide it with cutting as much as we could, because these are actually, again, National Guard helicopters. Now we get into the expository section. Charles Cyphers is playing the Secretary of State, and Lee Van Cleef is getting permission to send you in.
Yeah.
And all this section in the beginning is a basically straight plot kind of situation. The movie is an odyssey, and it's basically one adventure to the next with this main character traveling through this strange world. And as we talked about, the character is a guy who lives for the next 60 seconds. He doesn't care about anybody, and he's a survivor, and he's the toughest guy on the planet. And it was fun to get you to play that role.
Yeah, well, John, I'd like to do that.
There you are in silhouette to come in and make your entrance here. We have a dialogue scene. Had I had more time in the schedule, I would have covered this in more ways than I did. Basically, you have a big wide master shot here for the two of you. And then you have close-ups. And because of our time limitations, I think we even do a couple of closer shots. But it worked out pretty well. The acting was so good in this sequence.
He was fun to work with. I remember working in this scene thinking it would be the first time that you met the character. And I was sort of looking to you that day as to, are we over, under, or where are we here?
I always felt that your characterization was great, because he's a soft-spoken guy, but at the same time, he's the criminal they all fear so much. And he has no respect for anybody. His lines indicate that he doesn't know who's president, he doesn't know who's what, and where he's going, and he doesn't care nonetheless. And he's the kind of a guy after my own heart, where he doesn't care about things that other people care about. He's a very self-contained, self-motivated person, and he's the best at it.
I remember one of the things we talked about was the self-lighting cigarette. We didn't have that in the budget either. We tried to make that work. Remember, with a couple of...
And actually, that was your idea. You thought in the future, wouldn't it be great if you could just pull on a cigarette and it would light itself? Unfortunately, as I recall, you burned your fingers.
Yeah, you could light your fingers, but you couldn't light a cigarette.
We had just a little bit more money, we could have figured those things out. He had a lot of hair in those days, Kurt.
Remember we talked about everybody having short hair except for Snake, that he was going to basically be the only sort of unkempt-looking... guy, and for the most part, other than those who were in the prison of New York, everybody outside did pretty much.
It's true, and you know how hard it is in those days to get people to cut their hair.
Yeah.
The style hadn't changed yet. Everybody wanted long hair. It was still kind of the 60s and 70s. The Reagan Revolution hadn't taken hold yet.
This was 1997, right?
Supposed to be in 97, yeah.
That's hard to believe we're 3 years from then.
Isn't it strange looking at it now? Again, you see the dialogue scene is covered in very few angles, and there's not a lot of moving camera in this situation, partially because of budgetary reasons, but partially because I felt the performances could just hold themselves. And it's a classic confrontation between two men who are on opposite sides of a situation, but really are basically the same underneath. And now we get the expository sequence where they tell you what you've got and tell you what you have to do. We were trying to incorporate all sorts of weapons and martial arts, and I love your smile
in
this scene.
One of the few times he kind of, I like that.
This is your tracer button. Again, we're shooting this whole entire sequence in a university here, locally in Los Angeles. And coming up is a sequence that Lee Van Cleef told me was the most difficult in the movie. And he had to walk down a hallway and talk at the same time and deliver all this exposition without missing a word. And it was very difficult. A lot of the older actors are more used to hitting their marks, saying their lines, and then moving on. And for him, this was difficult. He had a lot of exposition, and we were on a Panaglide at this point, walking around corridors, down hallways, and did a great job.
The Panaglide was another thing that was fairly new, wasn't it? I mean, I had never worked with a Panaglide before.
In those days, yes, it was just developed in the late 70s, and we began to use it, and it was it hadn't really been used too much. A couple of shots in the sequel to The Exorcist used it, and very well. We used it as a tracking shot without a dolly, and it worked out pretty well.
Gave it an eerie quality too. I thought that was a byproduct of this, that camera that also helped the overall feeling.
It was a floaty quality, almost you're following characters. Here we show a sequence that indicates that the police state really is just about as bad as the prisoners inside. They inject. Snake with
those things.
a little problem in his neck. And really what we come down to here is this is a world where there are very few good guys left. There's a lot of oppression and brutality, and yet the man who shines and carries out the mission and is the most dependable and the most courageous of all is the most despicable, toughest criminal. And I really enjoy that setup. He's a tough man in a tough time, but he comes through for us.
I remember also when we were going through the wardrobe for Snake, what it was going to be, and you and I kind of discussed his background and the fact that maybe he had been in a war in Siberia. And so instead of wearing green fatigues, we thought, well, if it was Siberia, it was probably black and white.
Black and white.
So we went with black and white. And that was also a costume that didn't exist at that time. And
exactly.
I noticed after that that
with the zippers, I like it.
Zippers around the neck and black and white fatigues.
And you worked out quite a bit to get here.
That was really kind of that worried me because the guy really did have to be. I didn't think he had to be big and strong, but he had to be quick and nimble and obviously strong. And I wasn't that. So I had 4 months, I remember, to get in shape, and I went down to the local gym and found a gym rat who did the best he could.
Well, it's amazing the various disguises that you've acted under. I mean, from Elvis to this is a pretty amazing leap. Here you are, a man of action, and there you were, the king of rock and roll.
Oh, I can remember looking at the scar there on the left cheek, remembering that we thought we could tone my dimple down. We could take advantage of the dimple. We could say, well, we don't want him to look like he has a dimple. How about we put a scar there?
It's great. I think the eye patch was your idea.
I'm trying to remember how that
you just
that came
you, you
about.
Just came just, up with yeah. it once. You said, you know, I think you should wear an eye patch. You tried to get me also to let you lift the eye patch and show that you had no eye. But I didn't go that far. Now we're out at Indian Dunes, which is a little airstrip out north of Los Angeles. And what you're about to see is the glider taking off. Actually, we really did this for real, and this is a real glider, which unfortunately the company bought after we kind of bumped it. No one would buy it. But these are really amazing. I would never get in one because it doesn't have an engine.
I know what you mean. But, you got one shot at landing.
Yep. And
it wasn't easy getting in with those golf cleats on the toes. you'll see those later on with Brain when I put my foot up against him, but we had golf cleats coming out the front of the boot. This was fun.
Again, we're dealing with a limited budget, so these are all real tiny sets inside the glider there that we're using lights and animation to indicate technology. where if we had a little bit more money, this could have been a more elaborate sequence. However, I think probably because we didn't, we're a little more creative with it. I also like the way your eye glistens.
Yeah, and I can remember that I had the patch that had, I had two patches, one that was blacked out for close shots and one that was perforated so I could see a little bit for action shots.
Because you realize the problem with having an eye patch is you can't see anything on your peripheral vision off your left, and that's a big problem.
And your depth perception is just shot.
Don't want Snake to bump into the furniture. Now we're setting up the tracer that he has on his hand in order so the audience can understand, okay. And here we go again with the New World special effects folks who did just an incredible job in actually making you believe that he's flying into to New York. This entire sequence I attribute to them. Now this computer graphic was done by building a small model out of cardboard boxes and painting them black and covering them with green lines, because we didn't really have, again, computer technology then.
That's
really, really nice effects shots.
Great music here, too, I remember. It was just eerie, but kind of beautiful. It was really effective.
It comes, all this sequence is really well done, and relatively inexpensive at the time. And here we go in terms of our little model. We have a camera tracking through it. This was done by a schoolmate of mine, John Wash.
How did you come up with the idea of having monitors in the? Because I mean, the other thing existed at that time, and that's actually coming to be
an aircraft. I don't know. It's just probably all this is an offshoot of the James Bond movies. If you recall, they all had great gizmos.
Yeah.
And any kind of action movie needs that. So he's about to land on top of the World Trade Center, which is an interesting sequence because we're coming off a small model here, and then we're going to go into a larger model, and then we're actually going to go onto a live set, which we built out in Indian Dunes, coming up here in a second. And this was where we actually bumped our little glider and smashed it against the edge and couldn't sell it for a long time. Air brakes, anchors. A lot of fun. He crashes at the edge.
We'll worry about getting off later.
Exactly. And there we are. And now we're going to take you across the roof and supposedly down an elevator into New York. This is not what the top of the World Trade Center looks like. It was what our set looked like to hide various things, but... no one seemed to mind the inaccuracy.
This was about to be my toughest moment in the movie here, physically. We had a lot of action to go, but this right here was a surprise to me.
You like those, don't you?
I remember a couple of the other takes for bigger explosions where I fell on my ass. Going.
I remember once when we were doing Big Trouble in Little China, you had one of those near your head. You didn't enjoy it very much. Those are fun. They can really sneak up and surprise you. Now you're going to go down the elevator and you're going to come out in the upstairs of the Wiltern Theater, which is an old, beautiful old deco theater on Wilshire and Western.
I remember another thing that was interesting here was to go in with we talked about this a lot, was not a lot of weapons, not a lot of visible
Correct.
Weapons.
He has to kind of survive on his own. And this at the time, this particular theater was abandoned and run down, so we spray painted it and use the upstairs. You saw a shadow move in the background. There was actually, the building was originally inhabited by a tribe of American Native Americans, but we decided to eliminate them from the show. Now we're fading in back to St. Louis, and this is one of our most ambitious shots in the picture. This is a Panaglide shot that starts on one block and follows you down a street, and we begin to slowly reveal parts of the environment. We're going to get to a fire and some people in a minute.
I can remember feeling really good when I got into the shot because I remember waiting for the shot. I had to go around the corner and wait. While I was around the corner waiting, I didn't know who I was going to run into. And a couple of guys came around the corner and they saw me with that gun and everything. They didn't know what I was or who I was. And they just turned around and went the other way.
I don't blame them.
I was glad to get in here.
Now we start to pan around, and this is blocks and blocks of lighting. This took us hours to get, and there is a an actual airplane that we purchased. It had been in a crash, but we purchased it and cut it up and set it in the middle of the square in St. Louis. And there were actually people reporting a plane crash because they saw it there.
This was sort of Joe Alves at his best, I guess.
This was. And Joe Alves is the production designer, just did an incredible job. He's extremely famous before we worked together, and he did an amazing job for us on very low budget. Here you are walking by the plane, full size, everything lit. And this is as big as we got in the picture, and it was really worth it. It really sets up what's going on. This is an extremely hot and humid time, and we're working all nights. And as you know, when you work all nights, it's a very strange life. Real life kind of passes you by. You wake up in the afternoon, and you have to readjust your thinking. But we really got some good footage.
We were doing things here with Snake too. We wanted to grab his attitude here. I think then we sort of shut off. Who was it, Van Cleef at this time talking to him? I said we sort of treat him with disdain.
See, I can see how much younger you look than. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Oh, I remember that.
And we had to shoot a few inserts of you walking around. Now we're walking down the street. We're a few blocks away in St. Louis up to the famous Fox Theater, which has been restored and has become a big rock and roll showcase now. It's a beautiful, gigantic deco theater. This is the outside of it. And this particular sequence was conceived and written by my co-writer, Nick Castle, who has since become a director. He directed Dennis the Menace and Tap, and he wrote Hook. And he conceived the idea that the prisoners would actually try to put on their own Broadway show. There are several members of the crew and cast in the orchestra. You might recognize, I'm in there playing the violin, and several people are around. But this is interesting. You go into the Fox Theater in St. Louis, and you end up back in the Wiltern Theater in Los Angeles. There we go, in Wiltern, through the lobby. This has also been restored. It's a beautiful theater. They put on live concerts there now, often comedy and so forth. But all the torches and all the lighting is just, I have to give Dean Cundey an enormous credit here. He really made this thing very rich. Lots of smoke. We didn't mind the smoke in those days, though, did we?
No. But, you know, it really was. It was a difficult thing because you're going to go into a town that had no electricity at night, and you were going to have to see everything, and that was...
How are you going to do it? Here comes Borgnine. He was a lot of fun to work with. He's a big-hearted guy.
Yeah.
Let's see.
He hasn't aged at all.
It's amazing, isn't it? He never will.
No. Now, was Nick up there?
He wasn't. He was playing the piano.
You're playing the violin?
I'm playing the violin. here you come. The Wiltern Theater actually did resemble this a lot. It was very, very rundown and dirty, but it had that deco feel to it. Yeah. Now we're actually continuing in the theater. You're going to go down into the bowels of the theater here. This is the part that always gets cut out from television.
Yeah. I remember this was a big bone of contention because when I see the girl getting tossed around, remember there was a lot of you were getting a lot of heat about him. He doesn't try to help her. He doesn't do anything. That's who he is. It's none of his business.
Traditional American hero, of course, would stand up and say, "Now you can't treat that lady like that." What does Snake do? He minds his own business.
Ain't my life, ain't my wife. Why worry about it?
There you go. So now we're down underneath in actually the bowels of the theater, which were quite ripe at the time, as I recall. I believe that several folks actually came in here to live. And it's an amazing place down here. It's very, very dark. And this is where some of Dean's lighting got its edgiest. Here we go. Now we're into this particular sequence here. Nah, did we cut it out? Did they cut it out in this cut? Let's see if we did. There we go.
There they are. He's got a helper. No, he doesn't.
Now, the actress who played this tried to talk me out of doing this, but
Okay. That's interesting.
You like your reaction?
And we were coming up here to the first bit of action for Snake, or movement, or some kind of physicality. And remember, we tried to make everything as swift and devastating as possible with limited movement.
And the idea being that since he's so good at fighting, you know, his fights are not going to last very long because he takes care of business real quickly. Headbutt.
And that was one of the first times I'd headbutt. I'd never seen that before, and we talked about that. And you see that a lot.
You see it all the time now.
Yeah.
So now Snake is moving onward, and the lighting continues to change. Again, we're using silhouettes and very edgy lighting, and now we're going to come up to Buck Flower. Who has done, throughout the years, done so many parts for me and has been so great. He's just a terrific actor, and now he's going to, for a minute, we think it might be the president. Of course, it isn't.
Mr. President.
Buck is a very, very talented actor.
He's great. Yeah.
And extremely funny.
He was great here.
He was supposed to sing Hail to the Chief. And I think he ended up singing something else because I don't think he knew Hail to the Chief. Sounds a little like a Christmas carol.
Woke up and there it was. It's like a miracle.
So here we go. Back in... back at the police force thinks that the president, of course, is dead. But we learn from the plot that...
What was his character's name? He was named after...
Cronenberg.
Cronenberg.
He was named after
right.
David Cronenberg.
Right.
Now...
All right, get your machine ready.
Basically, we're at the turning point in the film where Snake is lost. He's he doesn't have any place to go. The president isn't attached to the monitor. And so, story-wise, you're opening up the whole thing for Chance. What's going to happen? What can Snake do? How can he survive? You know, he still has that those things implanted in his neck, and he has a time limit.
A little human compassion.
Now, coming up here is one of my... all-time favorite sequences in the movie. This is another big shot that we took in St. Louis. You're seeing down blocks and blocks of street there. You come up to kind of examine the egg that fell from the plane, and it's a moment of hopelessness for Snake. What's he going to do? And it's a contemplative moment for the character. You know, usually in action pictures, the hero is almost always a kind of a brutal, tough loner, but he never takes a moment to kind of contemplate what's going on. And this is a scene coming up I really, really enjoy.
We talked about this, and these were the things that you and I felt we could find as we were shooting the movie that would offer something for the audience to counteract the fears of the studio at that time of him being socially unredeemable. And we just decided to sit him down in a chair for a second and kind of show his...
Old kitchen chair, there he goes. And, you know, it's the thing about making movies, Kurt, that I love so much is that you can't plan certain things. And certain things happen through chemistry and ideas on a set that you can never plan for. Now, here we go with a sequence where the crazies are coming. This has always been one of my favorites.
And it's been so empty up till now. It's been so... empty, devoid of human beings.
Now we're going to start to see him pour out of the manholes. This whole idea was kind of beginning to be as if they were kind of cannibals. We never went into that too deeply, but it's a little Night of the Living Dead. But heck, you need something like that in here.
It was always the stuff that was fun here too. Was that this character never reacted right away to something? He sort of took a beat and then. Slowly wandered towards what was going on, maybe.
Well, he's a smart man. He doesn't respond immediately to things. These are, of course, wooden manhole covers. If you've ever tried to lift one of those things, you know that it's physically impossible. It would break your back trying to lift it from below. So they're all made out of wood. And we're still in St. Louis at this point in this entire sequence. And here come the extras, and we're going to make a transition now from St. Louis back to Indian Dunes, the set, and here we are. We're on a set in Indian Dunes in north of Los Angeles, near the side of
Chock
the famous...
Chock full of nuts. That was that.
This was near the site of the helicopter crash on Twilight Zone. Luckily, we weren't around. A great set again by Joe Alves. Rats running around and...
There's the golf cleats.
Now we're going to come up to a scene that with your first wife, Susan Hubley, a very, very talented actress, very beautiful. And at the time, as I recall, she was she had recently given birth to your to your son.
Right. Boston was very young. I don't 4 months, five, maybe 6 months old. And it was the first thing she'd done since she'd had the baby. We did this in, what was this? We had to do it in one or two nights. Because,
as I recall, you did the dialogue scene with her in one night.
One night.
I loved her look here. She had her hair all spiky and cut, and she was really playing a tough girl. Susan has an enormous amount of talent as an actress. I really enjoyed working with her.
She really does. And she was great here. And I remember we kind of worked on this dialogue a little bit. Remember to try to give it a sense of history. And I remember the names of two gangs that were in my neighborhood in Los Angeles. Was it the Turks and the...
And the... I can't remember the other names. She's terrific. We don't know what's going to happen here, but she's an example of somebody who is a survivor. I mean, she runs around with the gangs. And here for a moment, we're thinking maybe that Snake's going to hook up with her. There's a little bit of sexual tension here, and she tries to maybe let me go with you, Snake. And I really enjoyed what you guys did here.
Yeah, it was tough because really we didn't want to have him kiss her because of the circumstance, because of who he was. But we didn't want to make him totally asexual, although I think pretty much that was what we ended up with.
But there are a few sparks going here. Yeah. You kind of get the idea.
Yeah.
And he's not in the best of moods at this particular time. We shot this in one night, and it's a very, very low light level. There's just, as you can see, there's just kind of fill light on you guys, a little bit of highlight on your face.
There was great dialogue here, too, in terms of what this kind of movie is, because he was very self-deprecating.
Again, I think he's an unusual hero. Here we go. And I thought there was a great moment here. Because he knows what's happening, but he's not reaching for her in any kind of a traditional way. Now we're into the action again. Here comes our assistant director. Oh, down she goes. It was great. She did that great. The stuntmen were under there to catch her.
He only tries to help her for a little while.
Man,
I better take care of myself here.
Now we have a little action scene where you run through our set there. And this took the rest of the time, another night we did this entire sequence. Very, very difficult and challenging to do this so fast.
Yeah, we were flying by the seat of our pants here. I remember we were trying to come up with stuff to do that wasn't too much, but was enough.
You did a lot of physical work in this, Kurt. You're climbing up things and jumping over things and going through windows. And in a minute, we're going to make a transition from... our set again back to St. Louis, and you were in great shape at this time, and you were really roaring. As I recall, we came back to do some inserts a few months after shooting, and you put on a little bit of weight.
It doesn't take long.
I think the costume didn't fit you too well. And breaking windows, and you're coming out with bare arms. That's tricky.
Yeah, and his gun was tough because that gun kept whapping me. And we didn't have a lighter double gun.
Now you're going over the wall. We break your thing, and now you're coming over the wall into. You're coming into St. Louis.
And you just keep adding. What's interesting with this character too was that you, with what you did in terms of writing, you just kept adding more, in terms of adversity.
He had more and more problems as he went along, didn't he? And yet he kept dealing with it. Now you're going to run into Borgnine again. Again, Panaglide. Here we go down a hall. Kind of an alley, and it's a nice feeling to be able to glide along like this. It's not like a dolly. And then we come up to the cab, and this is Nick Castle's character that he wrote, the cab driver who still remembers the old days. And Borgnine was a perfect choice for it. He has a great joy of life. Also, Castle's idea was the American Bandstand situation, which was the height of absurdity. And Cabby's talking about all the rules of New York, and he's going to throw a Molotov cocktail and kind of take care of business.
And another spot where even I thought, God, I don't know, how do you pull a gun on this guy? Because he's just so likable. But it was sort of threading a needle.
It was threading a needle, but we wanted to keep him pure. We didn't want Snake to descend into movie land. We wanted him to be unusual. Now we're on a sound stage, sitting in a car with a lot of lights going on, shooting dialogue.
Guys running by with...
Again in St. Louis, under the bridges. A lot of lighting involved in all the exteriors that you see. Interiors were a lot easier for us. We're back in Los Angeles.
The staging of this was kind of different because normally a director would have you, and a cinematographer would have you move a little bit further to the left there where you're completely clear, and we didn't do that. We kept him almost behind Cavi.
Now we're introducing the idea of the Duke of New York, and the Duke has the president. And I was talking with Deborah Hill the other day, and Isaac Hayes sent a message to both of us and said, "I'm not dead, man. You guys do a sequel. I want to be part of it."
He was terrific. I worked out with him. I'd wake up sometimes in the morning because we were working all nights, and I'd wake up in the morning, and Isaac would say, "Well, call me tomorrow morning." And I'd call. I'd wait as long as I thought I could, and then I'd call, and the lowest voice in history would answer the phone. There's no way to describe how low his voice was after a night of work.
Now we're coming up to, I think it's the Masonic Temple in St. Louis. Again, this is a trashed and deserted area. And we come up to the temple, to the building now, and... in a moment, we're going to run into my first wife, Adrienne Barbeau, a very, very fine actress.
She was great in this. She was the teenage dream. I mean, she just personified everything a boy kind of says, "Boy, I'd like to meet her."
I recall when you guys did this scene. I remember her reaction. You played it a certain way. You had a certain line that you delivered with a slight edge of sexuality to it, and she just cracked up. She thought that was the greatest.
Right.
I had a lot of fun doing this.
Snake is running out of time now. Dying on the vine.
And we're about to move again in locations from St. Louis, where we shot this scene. Scene at the door. Finally opens up here in a second.
And out comes...
Adrienne.
Wait a minute. This got even Snake's attention. If I got 6 hours to live or whatever it is, this might not be a bad way to spend it.
Adrienne loved this character. She really enjoyed her. She enjoys playing a tough girl. And I believe this was the line...
I want to meet the Duke.
...that she enjoyed so much. That's the smile there. There we go. Now she reacts to it. Glances at Borgnine.
Speaking a language of their own here.
And in we go to USC Library. Back to Los Angeles. Here we go. We dress
this was an amazing set. I'd never seen that USC Library. You must have spent quite a bit of time in there.
I did. I went to USC and used to come in there. We're in the main library now. And in a minute, we're going to transfer over to the Philosophy Building Library, which is an incredible place. Again, Cundy's lighting is just so beautiful.
Wardrobe is fabulous in this, too, isn't it? I mean, I was just...
lots of browns and blacks and the future and the past combined. Here we are in the philosophy library. And
I walked in and I saw this and I said, "Oh, man, look at that. An oil derrick. This is perfect."
And now we meet Harry Dean, who is one of the most amazing people of all time.
And he has not changed at all. I saw him about a month ago and he's exactly the same.
A great actor, an amazing human being, and an unchanging person.
Yeah.
He enjoyed playing this role. He played it as a young poet, he said.
Yeah, with his cravat, holding up his demeanor in this.
Now, you had some cleats on your shoes, is that right?
Yeah, this was we had the golf, anything that would serve as any kind of offensive weapon on any part of your body, and... We screwed in golf cleats on the tips of the toes, because, of course, that would be the most Snake could afford. That was tough. This was hard holding that gun. It only weighed about 30 pounds, and I was running out of gas.
You did a good job. I couldn't tell. Could have been a rubber gun as far as I know. We had to shoot this sequence in a day, as I recall. Again, we had a low budget, and we didn't have a whole lot of time. So you're talking about conservation of work here. A very good scene, and Harry Dean is extraordinary. He's got a great sense of comedy and a great sense of drama at the same time. I believe you guys were talking about Fresno Bob and what happened to him.
Where did Fresno Bob come from? He was
in the middle of the night someplace. out of my
He was important,
dreams.
Though. This was, now this is about as conniving as Snake ever got.
And he's going to threaten his old friend. And basically, Snake has to take care of business no matter what. Now he has a line on where the president is, so he's going to get a little tough.
I've forgotten the backstory on the two of them, except that they were involved.
They were involved in a robbery together. Snake was left, and Harry Dean got away. Unfortunately, Harry Dean got sent to prison.
I thought one of the things that made this scene play and made the audience go along with it was that we hadn't sacrificed any of the believability for Snake in terms of his unlikability and his potential violence. You really believed, I think the audience believed there, that he very well might just shoot this guy.
Kill him.
Whereas if you take other scenes prior to that and come off of Snake, you might not have believed it.
And we're back in St. Louis again, and we're about to... Isaac Hayes is about to make his entrance.
This is maybe my favorite entrance in a movie ever. John was alluding to what was going to take place here. I'd never seen this car, and when I saw it for the first time, I cracked up. I've since seen that car on the streets of L.A.
You got a Panaglide shot, very ambitious, and we're in St. Louis, and down the street comes... the Duke and his caravan.
I always felt that in that shot, anybody could have been walking with Adrienne. We could have been doing cartwheels and throwing knives, and nobody would have been noticing.
The cabbie takes off.
Cabbie,
the coward
smart.
That he is. And here
she
we
was
come.
A gutsy girl. This is the best. Again, Snake doesn't just peel off and go. Finally thinks better of it.
Snake is a total individual in a world devoid of individuality, so he's going to do it his way. We put the hydraulics in the car, man. And jacked up the back.
And
there's Ike. You can't get any cooler than that.
You cannot get any cooler than that, and if you're going to be stuck in that situation for the rest of your life, why not put some chandeliers on your car? Oh, man. I love, too, that you wrote this and chose to not have any kind of futuristic cars. And this, again, 14 years ago, it would have been an easy sort of decision to do that, to go with what might be in the future. And you took old cars that were...
Old cars. Again, it's part of including a little bit of the reality and a little bit of the past into the future, which kind of gives it a different kind of resonance. Ike knows how to take stage, doesn't he?
Oh, boy. Did you ever work, when you were shooting it, and of course you had the whole movie in your head, and there's very few directors that really do have the whole movie in their head, but were you ever concerned about that car or things like that being just too much or a little bit more than, because it wasn't?
Well, you're always on the fine line between going way over the top with something and hitting it just right. I think the thing is you just got to take a chance.
Yeah.
It's just like a performance. Yeah. You know, you got to go out and do it and see what happens. Now, here you come up to apply a little bit more physical pain here, I think.
Yeah. Well, there's Dick Warlock. Now, Dick was, bang, Dick was my stuntman and had been my stuntman. Well, he was my stuntman for 22 years. And
when did you first work with him?
I was trying to remember. We worked together, I think, on, it might have been a picture called... at Disney called,
Computer War Tennis Shoes?
Computer War Tennis Shoes. That was it.
Really?
That was it. 1968 or 9.
They're remaking that now, you know.
You're kidding.
No.
You're
remaking
kidding.
That, yes.
Oh, boy. They're pulling them out of the...
Maybe you want to play the father or something now.
It's either me or Tom Bosley.
So off we go here, and now we're going to go into a little interior sequence dialogue here, and we're going to go make a little trip down Broadway. One of the critics, and I forget who it was complaining about the fact that our Broadway, which was shot in St. Louis, was like a four-lane street, and of course we all know that Broadway's a bigger street than that. I want to say, give me a break, guys. You know, we didn't have...
I was concerned about looking cool in a 64 station wagon.
And this was a very a difficult sequence to pull off totally. We shot it, and to get the sound effects right, to get everything to work right, and to get the rubber bricks not to look too bad.
And there's an element of comedy here that within the action that we had to hold. And I remember I was a little concerned about that, of being too
broad.
Too broad, or the lines being too broad. I was afraid that, uh-oh. But we got it. I mean, it was stuff that worked. Yeah, those rubber bricks were great.
I always felt this kind of resembles New York right now.
Yeah.
This kind of feel right here.
After a bad day on Wall Street.
And we're going to go through, we're going to do a little stunt here. I believe that that Dick Warlock did this.
This is Dick, yeah.
He also did the driving stunt
he was
coming
driving.
Up in a second.
He was driving, shooting himself and everything.
And we're again back in St. Louis here, and he's going to center punch this wall of cars.
Remember, he tried to do the 180 there, and the car just didn't have enough juice to do that.
Too old a car. Here they come. What's Snake going to do?
I'm thinking about it here. I like the way that's cut together. It has that element of, like, there's no way they can make it out.
It was one of our few two-camera stunts at that point. And now we're off and running. We're coming up to a location now that is the train station in St. Louis, which is abandoned. And this shot right here is, again, one of our biggest. That's hundreds and hundreds of feet back there to the train. And it took a great deal of the time at night to light it. That particular shot was in the rain one night, and we didn't think we were going to get it. You can see the rain hitting the pavement there, but now we're back to non-rain. And the train sequence was there we go. Now we're into the train sequence was huge. It's immense area there, and this is all deserted.
It's
I don't know
inside,
if they've ever
it?
Brought it back or not.
Remember the mayor was talking about making it into a shopping mall?
Exactly. I don't know if they did or not.
I think they did.
Did they?
Yeah, I think they did. I'm not sure either, but I think they did.
Here we are, and we have a Pantaglide shot, which is rather complex. You see you creep out here, and we move forward, and then in a second you're going to see Dick Warlock running along the top of the train, as I believe, as I remember.
Yeah, Texas Switch.
You can do the Texas Switch several times in this movie. And the lighting, the kind of sulfurous...
I thought Harry Dean was great in this scene.
And now up on the train, you're going to raise the Pantaglide just slightly to see Warlock creeping along. The vistas in this are really difficult to beat, and it's amazing to me now, sitting and watching this, that we were able to get all this on the schedule and the money that we had.
Amazing.
If you were
to do this picture now, just the way we did it then, how much do you think now it would cost?
Double, triple, four times as much, over 30 or 40 million.
Gee.
Easily. Now we're into the train car.
Who is that guy?
I don't recall his name. I don't remember his name. You've just dispatched someone back here.
This was a tough little gag with that.
Junk. And you took a little arrow there without really reacting to it too much.
Yeah, no, not too much. It's just an arrow, after all.
That's correct. Just a slight limp.
And now you walk up and you meet the President of the United States.
Yeah.
And treat him with due respect.
Donald had the time of his life making this. He loved doing this. He loved playing this character. I had to convince him to do it in the beginning. He didn't understand why I wanted him. But once he got it, he just had a blast. Now we have another brief little fight coming up here, Kurt.
This was a great jump here. I remember the audience really came out of their seats on this. This was a sort of a patented Carpenter jump.
Yeah, cheap trick, but hey, that always works.
It was a good one.
Here you go. Coming up.
Got to turn that little, do that little walk.
Bango. I've also enjoyed the brief fight that you have here. Yeah. Again, it's your blocks are extremely good. Now you're going to get trapped here in a second.
Remember, this was great. We had a guy with one arm here.
Yep.
This was great.
And Ike comes up to...
shoving his stub into my throat.
The extras were terrific. They put their all into it, didn't they?
They got it. They just got it. Which is, it's easy to say now that they got it, but before anybody had done anything like this, to get them to understand it was...
Who knew? Exactly. Here comes Frank Doubleday. He's playing a character named after George Romero, the director of Night of the Living Dead.
I like the way he looks at Adrian's cleavage and then pulls his own shirt apart.
She's indicating that she still has a gun, and we're at basically a turning point in the film. The snake is captured. Ike has a great face, doesn't he?
Yeah. Now, you guys must have talked about the twitch.
He wanted to do the twitch. Only when he saw Plissken, though. Only when he saw Snake, it made him twitch.
I got... Yeah. Even that one woke him up. Tough to get Snake to react to pain, but boy, that was going to do it.
And we're again dealing with an action movie on the edge of comedy and on the edge of being a little broad, but we seem to pull it off. It's when you're in the future and you're in a crazy world like this, I think it allows you to go over the edge. I think Snake gets hit, doesn't he, here?
Oh, yeah.
He kind of gets knocked out.
Yeah. Heard you were dead.
Bang. And we're going to end up pretty soon here inside the train station for our famous fight with... but first...
Yeah.
As I recall, we made a day sequence come in here.
Are you...
I'm in the day sequence when we're dropping the food in a little while.
Those were really well done.
But the movie's all been and extremely dark up to this point at night. And at the time, I recall several people being very worried that we weren't going to have any contrast in our film. It was going to be too dark.
Yeah.
And so we designed a little a day sequence to brighten it up for the audience and give us a bit of relief. There you are, kind of knocked out.
Oh, and this is where we were going to discuss. We said, well, if... We might throw in a thing here for why they call him Snake. And I must say that after we did this, I got some of my favorite fan letters that I from girls who saw this tattoo. They thought that was pretty great.
A real shot of New York. We were out there at dusk.
I remember that day. I remember you guys were going to shoot early.
Yeah, it wasn't fun, but it's a beautiful shot. And
that was great.
We're into a little brighter visuals for the audience. That's actually a dusk shot in Los Angeles, but it's standing in for dawn and
real heroic shot, isn't it?
No, Lee is needs a lot to play it. Now you wake up from your dream and you're about to get taken to a big fight and
waking up to that.
Now this is the interior of the train station, and they had several areas. This is one big area. There's ballrooms, and there were restaurants, and all this was deserted and trash. So we really didn't have to do too much to it.
Boy, that place was massive.
It's huge. We do the Torment the President sequence here, which gives Donald a reason for his feelings at the end of the picture. One of the big problems in this scene was whenever Ike shoots, there's a bullet that's coming out of there, and it's going to hit Frank Doubleday in the head if we're not careful. Now, here's your tattoo.
Here's a tattoo.
That disappears below the belt line here. If you still got any of those letters, I wouldn't mind reading them at this point. A lot of crossbows and ancient weaponry, because we figure all these prisoners don't have the access to guns, just the Duke does. And
gosh, this takes me back now. And when you made the pictures that you and I have after this one, the simplicity of this time, we just had fun, didn't we? It was just, you're just dancing on your feet, you were, whatever would work.
And it was true. There's something that is on the screen from that time. I mean, it was the beginning of my career, and you'd been acting for many years, but it was the beginning of a second part of your career.
Adult career, and I never had anything remotely like this, the opportunity to do anything like this, and I'd always felt that I would feel comfortable in a role like that. You were the only one that was willing to take a chance on me doing that.
Well, I figured you could play Elvis. You can play anything. And here we have Donald being humiliated. Again, you kind of see the beauty of a widescreen movie, because you have so much screen space in this rectangle to play. And if you use wide-angle lenses, it really gives a sense of scope. And here goes Romero.
I love when actors take a role over like that. You notice the way he takes his sunglasses off. Nothing's done in an ordinary fashion.
And there was a great deal of freedom in this world to go ahead and play sequences like that. It's almost like a medieval film, except in the future. You've got a costume drama, and you've got a lot of outrageous characters. But everybody invests it with a certain reality. Now, we're about to get into this rather extensive fight coming up, and I recall at the time that we were dealing with Ox Baker.
Yeah.
Who's a 7-foot wrestler. Oh, now, before we get there, though, here's my debut in the helicopter. I'm not piloting at this point, but I'm throwing boxes out. It'll get to me in a second. This is over Los Angeles. With the National Guard, we're flying.
Where was that?
Now that's in the Sepulveda Basin, and that's a Jim Cameron Matt painting. He painted that on a piece of glass, right out there. There I am, right there.
That's about John. To, there you are.
There I am. And it's a really incredible visual effects for such a.
I know.
Such a modest budget, but we're about to drop. Some sort of clue about a snake, so that the police believe that they have to go in. Here we are.
using all the extras you could muster.
And here we come in. This is, again, before the Twilight Zone. Nobody really has any fear of helicopters at this point.
It's always sort of reminded me of, for some reason, I thought this was like Roots with a helicopter. It just looked like field hands. Chopper comes in, they take off.
And out come the extras stumbling around out of the helicopter. They can't see.
They can't see through those helmets.
They can't see through the helmet. And here we are back with Snake. Now, we actually hired a real professional wrestler, Ox Baker. He's over 7 feet.
Massive.
He was 300 and some odd pounds. And he was a nice guy, but he took parts of the fight in his role a little bit too seriously.
Well, and
and
what was interesting was that he was a professional wrestler.
Yeah, what the hell? You gotta land a glider and take off. You can't do it in Central Park. There's too many trees, Port Authority's too low to the ground, unless it was someplace high.
I remember Warlock rehearsing this scene with him. And the reason Warlock couldn't do a lot of the scene was because he had hit Warlock in the head, and Warlock had a gigantic lump on his head. And he told me, he said, look, all I can tell you is be careful and hang in there.
Now, Ox was a true tough guy. He when he stepped through the ring at one point, he cut his leg and showed absolutely no pain. And I said, God, doesn't that hurt? Do you want the medic to look at you? And he said, does what hurt? So I knew that we were dealing with a pretty rough guy here. In this particular sequence, we're back in Los Angeles and discovering that they think Snake is dead. So now we're going to rally the troops at Sepulveda Basin, a beautiful kind of dusk shot at our set.
Suspended reality here in terms of time. This was great.
And those helicopters sure made the film, didn't they? They gave it a real quality.
Yeah. Helicopters at that time hadn't been shot a lot.
They hadn't, you know, there was the Apocalypse Now, but it hadn't really been shown. Now, we have a nice long Panaglide shot of you entering the ring, so to speak.
This is the guy, the previous guy coming out.
Yep. This is a location that's in the train station, and this was once a very elegant restaurant for the patrons, and it was the spot where all the mayor and all the dignitaries in town would come for dinner. Now it's just literally trashed.
Yeah.
I always enjoyed this sequence because at one point in this fight, you are very realistic in trying to protect yourself against the blows of Ox Baker.
Yeah. One of the toughest thing about this day was that the snake was starting to sweat off of my stomach. So we had to keep retouching up the cobra. But this was one of the toughest things in terms of physicality that I ever, in 33 years, have ever been involved with in the movie business. This guy was...
he's a tough character.
He was half out of control. And I can remember at one point finally saying, you know, if you... You tagged me. I was okay once I had a baseball bat in my hand, and I said, "You tagged me. I'm telling you what. I'm not only going to hit you. I'm going to pull you."
Well, I remember he was beating you up pretty good, and you said to Warlock, "Why don't we talk to him a little bit? Here comes Ox now. He's an amazing human being," and it didn't change after we talked to him. No. So you tapped him gently in a certain area of his anatomy and said, "Look.
This is coming."
if you tag me, this is gonna come.
Yeah, we got to the end of this fight, and he did the best he could. He was really a very sweet guy, and
he wasn't coordinated in the sense of being able to have a very close physical contact without it being very brutal.
He's used to
a lot of
real contact.
Real contact.
He didn't understand movie contact very well.
And we were at a loss to explain it to him, but.
Oh, Jesus. That's just the way I felt.
Uh-huh.
I thought this was going to be a long 2 days. Look at the sweat coming off his head. But I remember we finally got to the end of this fight, and I had really taken a beating over, what was it, 2-3 days we did this, right? And finally it was, you'll see, it's time to kill him. And he didn't like that. He didn't like that.
We
had to put that piece of wood on his neck with that thing around his collar, and the only way we could get the bat to stick was to put the nail in the bat. And so now I was going to come down on his head, and I said, "Now you've had your turn, now it's mine." I said,
turn.
"Don't move."
You know, he didn't want to lose, that's for sure.
No.
Now, Ike gives a great speech here.
This is great. He was great.
And we introduce the weapons of the fight. Oh, he's having a good time. We introduce the weapons of our fight here pretty quickly, but we do see Ike telling us that basically, you're going to lose.
Yeah.
And that's a real wrestling ring. And we're in the train station again, and it's torch lit with a lot of smoke.
A lot of people in that scene. That was one of the few times we really had a bunch of extras.
We did. Now you're off and running. And
there we go.
We begin the fight. A lot of this is done with Panaglide. This is this wide shot is done on the floor with a dolly. But in the ring, we were using the Panaglide a lot. It was a lot easier to work with. Now, all these things with Ox here... you're barely kind of missing it.
Yeah.
And
whap.
Nice move. Now we're back with Harry Dean and Adrienne, and this whole sequence with Donald. Donald, the president, is being tormented. And he decided that he wanted to wear a wig during the scene because he was getting into his character. And he really brought a great deal of this pitiful humiliation to the president, which I greatly enjoyed, which was another thing that the studio was worried about. Well, if you guys make this much fun of the president of the United States, I don't think you should do that. And I said, relax, it's in the future, guys. You know, it'll be something that the audience will enjoy.
Yeah.
So now we're in an ante room, and there's Donald's contribution to the... to the fun.
Politics of America.
Exactly. The executive room. Now, we've established that Adrienne has the gun, so we know she's going to use it in a minute. And
Frank doesn't quite know if he likes this. That's great.
Again, that you get the sense that that these people are, in a way, small-time criminals, but they have a criminal code among them.
She enjoyed that.
Yep.
He died well, Frank, didn't he?
Yep. With a retractable blade. Now we're going to let loose the president. Now we change weapons.
Oh, yeah.
And this is, as I recall, in a minute here, is when we're going to see you really take some
shots.
Some pretty serious shots.
And
on
these
the,
bats now, I think, have nails in them.
Yeah, they're coming up. And they've got the trash can lids coming up. And
yeah.
Now you
see the... There was something about this scene that I just thought was great, and that was that here you are with this sort of quintessential American nightmare story. And if you're going to have it out, why not have it out with baseball bats? And if you're going to really have it out, why not have it out with trash can lids and nails and baseball bats? Real gladiator stuff. Oh, boy.
Now, they're making their escape. Again, we're utilizing the Panaglide whenever we can to float through sets. This entire sequence was shot in the St. Louis train station. It's really an amazing set. Here's where you're taking it.
Yeah.
Right in this area, especially when we get into some of the close-ups. He wouldn't back off you. Yeah. He wanted to. There you go.
When that guy was 350 or something, more than that, I guess. Yeah. I mean, he's swinging that bat. I want to tell you something.
You can feel it.
Oh, look at there that. Took a shot there and there.
There you go.
Oh, boy.
And you're doing a good job of kind of saving your own life.
Oh, boy. This was rough.
You have to.
And that was a tough thing, having that ripped out. And we had to connect. Remember, on that, we had to have those nails connect.
Yeah.
So he had to swing hard enough.
And you're rolling around in there.
And here it comes.
Here it comes.
Now this was what he didn't want. And those nails were real. And on the back of his head, he had that piece of wood. And it had to be in there hard enough to stick.
That's right.
He was worried about that. So
he did a great job. He planted it in the right spot.
He didn't move.
Now they're chanting Snake, and you have triumphed. And you grab back your tracer and push the button, and now we change the story around. The police force realizes you're still alive. They're going to give you another chance, and we're heading into the third act.
Yeah.
It's always nice to turn around the second act into the third. Basically, being an odyssey, Snake has gone through these terrible problems. He only has an hour and a half left before his head blows off. So,
it's got a problem.
He has some serious problems.
Oh, man.
So we're off and running into the final final chase sequence.
This guy was jacked up.
And I suppose if we'd the final end of the movie, we could have had we had a little bit more money, we could have gone on and on with it, and made it a little bit more. Like what you were used to seeing in the late 80s and these days, a diehard kind of a spectacle, but we didn't, so we stayed with the characters. Again, here we're back in Los Angeles, and Lee does not want to walk up to the helicopter, but I'm forcing him to do it. He hates him.
Download the choppers.
Download the choppers and get me out of here. So we're basically into the the final action sequence. And reutilizing, again, the animation to tell the story. We're over at CalArts now.
That was great what Tommy Atkins did there, too, because he took that character from being sort of one of those icy cold trooper types to a guy who smiles when he realizes that this guy
like
he has
Snake.
No much appreciation for, he has to respect him.
So you're going up the World Trade Center, we presume, to the very top, which I would imagine would take you a little bit of time, and you'd be a little winded, only to discover... a situation on top. Now they're arguing about what to do with you, and everybody's holding their own here. It's more animation to tell us you only have 59 minutes left, and here we are in the middle of a fight on the roof. Now these are brick throwing Indians who are chopping your glider, and off it goes.
Is that lion still in there? Damn Redskins. Oh, yeah, there he
is. And the president pops up. We were having a good time doing this. It was...
Remember the sound of those... And I remember that gun was kind of different.
We did. We processed the sound of the gunfire to make it sound slightly futuristic. And we're back in the Wiltern Theater. And reutilizing the sets that we used before, which is a kind of a little secret that you can do with low budget films and still make it look look like it's made for a reasonable amount of money. I think that it's hard to believe this was made for $5 million. I sit here now and think to myself, how did we do it? It may have been up to six, but that's a pretty low amount of money. This was made for Avco Embassy. At the time, was one of the few independents in Hollywood that wasn't the same as it is now. The movie business has changed a lot since then.
Yeah, it really has. And there was a. I remember in those days, one of the things that was interesting about the way the studio treated you was that they knew to really to leave you alone and to not mess with your movie.
I'd never really done a major studio film. My first major studio film for Universal came after this. We did it together. It was called The Thing. Yep. And it was a totally different experience, because when you work for the majors, they tend to try to exert much more control over you than you do when you're an independent. And so these were the good old days, Kurt.
it's the truth. It would be fun to attack a picture the same way.
Wouldn't it? It would be fun to go back and try to something this way again.
It forces you to think. It forces you to be creative. Yes. You just don't have the dollars to back you up.
So you have to do it on your feet, and you have to do it with your performances, and your storytelling has to be very straightforward. And in some ways, it's much more fun. And in some ways, you're taking more chances and getting more in return. So now we're on the chase. Now we're in Century City now, running out of the towers there, and here comes Cabby again. We're about to enter into our final chase, which is across the bridge. You decide to drive here, and
this is a bridge. And this is a bridge that you invented. You invented the 69th Street Bridge, right?
Yeah, we couldn't go on a real bridge in New York. Those things are huge, so we invented it, and we shot it in a very strange place. It's a little tiny bridge in rural Missouri, and across it was closed down. And the thing I remember the most about this bridge was that there was cicadas were flying all over at night and buzzing us, and it was very strange. Now, the whole MacGuffin of this movie is this tape. The president supposedly has something to do with fusion or fission or something.
Something's going to save the world.
That's right. It doesn't really matter, but it was something that we needed to get back. It's an important plot device that you can immediately forget and not worry about anymore. Now we're in...
This is a great shot. Was this the shot where you get the two of them?
Mm-hmm.
I love this.
And he's going by one way, and we come up across the bridge, and there you come the other way. And this was near downtown St. Louis. Now we're about to jump a bridge and do our stunt. Here we come. We're in the middle of the countryside,
this
miles
was big stunt,
from the
wasn't
city.
It?
And this is our big stunt. We built those buildings. There he goes, bang. And we're on the little bridge. It was a little tiny country bridge out in the middle of nowhere. It had been shut down for years, and... And these shots are extremely ambitious for us, considering that we have to light the whole bridge from above, and Cundy couldn't put any lights because there's water, the river is running right under there. We've got explosions on the bridge. We're cutting in and out between the set and a location. And here comes Ike in his car. He's going to jump the bridge. Ah, boy, that thing jumps, doesn't it?
And this is great music. I love the music every time you cut to him. It had that calypso kind of...
It's a little feel to it, doesn't it?
That was great.
And we have bombs going off. Roy Arbogast did the special effects, did a great job. Yeah. We had a great team working with us.
Really, they were moving fast, too. They were hanging by a thread.
We had to, and we just had to finish.
It was great here, I thought, because all these characters in a very short period of time had been, you cared about them all. You cared about Cabby. You cared about the president. You cared about Brain and Maggie. And
because of their humorous aspects, also they endeared you to them. They made you care about them. The cab is blown in half. We did that stunt twice because it didn't work the first time.
And the second time you had to put the car sort of back together again.
We had to put it back together and. This was the first scene we shot on the bridge here with you guys. Cabby, of course, is dead, and we've gotten rid of one of our actors. We're gonna eventually get rid of them all and get down to Snake. He's gonna end up alone.
That was great.
I recall my fear at this moment when I had, this was the first time I had worked with all of you together on that bridge, and Larry Franco turning to me and saying, "Would you relax?" I said, "You don't understand. You don't understand. I've got all these actors looking at me, and I don't know what to say to them." So now we're running down the bridge. There's a great stunt coming up here with Harry Dean.
Who did this?
Well, this was, I can't remember his name right now, but Harry hits the, we've set something off in the foreground, and there goes the stuntman in the reverse. It's a great old-fashioned trick.
Yeah, very tricky, too, because if you don't hit it stiff-legged, your knees go up through your through your jaw. This was good, too. This really paid the two of these
characters people. Get paid off right here, and then there's something they understand between them, and Harry Dean's gone now, and she has a certain loyalty to him, and he understands and respects that, but he's not going to wait for her.
No, and this is the only person he had any sort of feelings for in this movie. He really didn't want to see her have to die.
But she's going to do what she has to do.
Well, she is Maggie.
Yep. She's going to stay there and stand to the end.
Maggie with a gun. She wants that gun.
But she did a great job in this. She really invested the character with a sort of a psychotic sensibility.
Yeah, and it's interesting how in a very short period of time you can turn an audience from having a sort of campy kind of fun into a feeling of reality between two characters in a situation that's high-powered.
Turn on a dime, isn't it strange? Yeah. And now she's going to get into the power of the gun again and getting her revenge on Ike, only she doesn't. She gets nailed.
Up comes one of my favorite shots, the garage shot.
Garage shot.
I only heard about this and then saw it in the movie.
We shot Adrienne getting killed here, the stunt, with a dummy. There is a dummy coming up. Oops, she got hit, but we never saw what happened to her. So,
wasn't the studio, did they want to know that?
They didn't necessarily. I kind of wanted to
let everybody know that she was dead. In fact, and you shot that in your garage?
That's in my garage.
Yeah.
The last minute. And now we're getting ready to rescue the president and Snake from the bridge. And you're about to have your final showdown with Isaac Hayes.
That is a walkie-talkie.
Yep. Now, we built this wall on the other side of this country bridge. It was a huge wall, and it was as realistically as tall as the one in Sepulveda Basin. Now we're back in Los Angeles for this part of it, but I can't believe the amount of production value we got for the budget. I mean, it's really stunning. We put had to build the lights up on top, had to run electricity to all of it. Now we're back, we're cutting back and forth between St. Louis and Los Angeles. Here you come with the president. I believe we're shooting with a couple of cameras here. Yeah, we're to show the scale of it, but that's a real...
We talked location. Also about who should go up first.
Yeah.
We thought at this point in the movie, Snake should probably realize that the president was more important.
Needs to go up. Either that or they might kill him. Now, here comes Ike.
They might kill him first and he'd have a chance.
Up goes the stunt man. Here comes Ike. He's going to come. And now, are they going to get back down and save you? Now, we reinvented this little area here. He's running out of time. Oops. He's shooting everybody. Now you take a big dive onto a mattress there, don't you, Kurt?
Yeah.
But you're about to
come up from the deep.
Yep.
Ike was great here.
Now back comes the tie. Now he wants to get out also. He senses freedom, but there you go. Well, there goes somebody looks like
that. Yeah, that's Dick, I think.
Yep. And now you're into your fight. We did a couple takes of this. You guys are great here. And he was
another elbow shot.
Yep. He really put himself into it for a rock and roll star, man. He's great. Up you go. And
Isaac ever been in a movie before?
He had. He had done Truck Turner.
Oh, that's right. That's
and
right.
And he was... So the president stops you on the wall.
Right. Thanks a lot.
We think Snake's going to bite the big one. Here it comes. But...
Yeah, the Duke.
Here comes Donald. And Donald was actually... in World War II, was a pilot. He was a fighter pilot who was shot down in a Japanese... prisoner of war camp.
I never knew
that. And was tortured.
I never knew that.
And he invested his scene with a little bit reality there.
Yeah, and then he decides to let Snake
live. Now up goes Warlock to the top. And
Now Texas Switch.
We do a great Texas Switch here. For people who don't know what the Texas Switch is, it's an old stunt trick. You want to explain it?
Well, Dick's coming down, but he's about 20 feet. He's more higher in the air than it looks here. He's about 15 feet. He drops all the way down, and I come up.
And you're hiding behind the truck,
Hiding behind the truck.
Texas Switch. Old-fashioned, old-time Yakima Canutt stunt done with Wayne and all those guys. Okay, so now we have the moment of truth. We discussed briefly having the police turn around and say, we never did put anything in you, and it was all a trick. But we decided then again to go ahead and make it real. So now he's made it.
We're going to see if his head comes off.
Did you really take care of me or not?
You did see here that this guy wanted to live. He really did want to live. He wasn't not concerned.
So now we're done with the action, and we're into our ending. And this is, as far as I'm concerned, it's kind of a interesting ending. We have all this movie, you've struggled to survive and save the president. And the entire movie hinges on bringing him back so he can address the nation and present the tape that's going to, you know, ensure the future will have unlimited power. And what do? But you... you screw the police and the nation as well as you did everybody else.
And I remember this was written to flick the cigarette and actually bounce it off his chest. And I remember I kind of backed off of that one. I said, John, gee, that's a little rough, isn't it? And he said, well, just flick it at him.
And Snake is always evaluating character throughout this movie. He's always asking questions and seeing what he thinks of people. And he's decided now that the president really doesn't care about the people who sacrificed their lives for him. And
he's really there just for the self-serving purpose.
That's right. And so Snake's made his decision now that he's not going to let he's going to get some sort of revenge for that, because he's not going to let him get away with it. We're shooting this again at the Sepulveda Basin. This is the...
Donald was great here, too. He did have to face the nation. Boom.
Boom. And off you go.
And that was great.
Yeah, nice. Tom gives a nice look. Here. Now you have a nice little final scene with Lee, who expresses his... Lee is like you. He is you, in a sense. He admires you, and he wants you to come join the department. But I don't think Snake could ever join anything. I think he's much too much of a...
On his own man.
And
that was the first time he called him by his other name.
That's correct.
Yeah. They never looked at each other here until the very end.
And it's fun. You get to play a lot of great scenes with a lot of great actors. It's fun. Now, this was almost the self-lighting cigarette.
Right. Didn't quite work.
But it was a good idea.
The name's Plissken.
He did not like
my name. And off you go. Now we're going to have Donald present his findings to the world, and we're going to get your final shot. I've always been an admirer of Howard Hawks, and he's ended a lot of his movies on tracking shots with actors. And I always thought that was a great way to end this movie, with you kind of walking off in a fade out. Now, Donald loved the fact that he was giving a press conference with handcuffs on. He just couldn't get enough of that.
Yeah, they couldn't cut those off of him in time.
And he was a really great actor. He played the scene any way you wanted him to. Now he puts in the tape, and we find out it's American Bandstand, which Dick Clark graciously let me use.
This is one of the great expressions going here.
Yeah,
you can't believe it.
Such a good actor. And we end up with a final shot of you. We're tracking along with you. And you pull out the real tape, which is the future of mankind, and we can see how you feel. You destroy it, and your final character moment here, there's a slight smile and sense of satisfaction. You're free, and off we go. And we're going to run our end credits and finish it up, and it's kind of amazing to watch the picture now. It still holds up quite well for its time, and I'm reminded of what great time we had doing it.
Yeah, I just that was certainly one of the great experiences I ever had. It was still early on in yours and my relationship, although we'd gotten to know each other pretty good.
We had one under our belt already, and that's fun. A couple of old guys sitting around looking at the old days, though.
Yeah, it's a little strange, but I'm a fan of this movie. I've always felt that it would hold up, and I think one of the things that says that is that so many movies since then have really copied that style.
Oh, that's very nice.
A lot of pictures have tried to do that, and not only that, but I think, and I know for a fact, that a lot of videos, like MTV videos, have
I would agree, and I think a lot of people copied the way you played the main character. Also, would like to say to the audience, you know, rather than being pretentious, this is really the way that a director and an actor talk. It's really
it's what you and I do. Yeah,
it's really not a whole lot of laying on of themes and pretension. It's really straightforward. That's the way we love to make films, and I think that's the way that we should.
It was fun to come to a sense of shorthand speaking, which I think you and I had from very early on time when we were doing Elvis.
Yeah.
And I guess that happens because as an actor, you appreciate what the screenplay is, and this was yours, and I just thought it was a wonderful opportunity, and I was really glad you fought for me to do the picture. I remember they wanted
Charlie Bronson.
Charles Bronson. And you wanted to have a younger kind of guy, and that took a lot of guts, and I think that the outcome was terrific.
Well, we had to stick together, man. I mean, we had to pull it all. Hey, it's been fun, and I hope the audience out there is watching this has enjoyed it, and I've had a good time going back through the movie. I haven't seen it in so long. It's fun to see it again.
It is. It reminds me of how I felt at that time, and that was that every day out there, I always had you, and that was great.
Hey, that's neat. Yeah. All right, guys. We'll see you later.
See you in the movies.